Greetings. This is Eric Andelin, Senior Workflow Specialist with SimActive, and you're listening to our podcast, Pixels and Points, with our special guest, Marty Gould of Beacon Aviation. Hey, Marty, why don't you say hi?
Good morning. Nice to be on, Eric.
Happy to have you on. Marty, I know you're based in Texas. You've been around for a while. Can you kind of share with the audience what you've been doing, where your company's located, what type of aircraft you have, and so forth?
We're located here in East Texas, about 90 miles east of Dallas. The airport we operate out of is Wood County Airport. It's Kilo Juliet Delta Delta. We've been in East Texas since 95, and the company started in 93 is actually Martin Aviation. My name is Martin Gould. And then in 94, we incorporated as Beacon Aviation, Inc. And we did various things with the aircraft, and one of them that really led to the mapping was surveillance. We had a contract with Citco Pipeline where we fly the Cessnas, the 172s, just down the right of way and give a visual report. And then it got exciting when in 95, 96, we started doing what we called image mapping with a digital camera, and it took off from there. And so in 97, we've been wholly dedicated to aerial mapping since 1997. We've captured and delivered over 1,000 projects.
So when you were originally doing, assessments of right-of-way and things like that, when you were just flying the 172, were those for pipeline projects out there? Were they for utility corridors? Kind of what was that?
Yeah, the contract with Citco also led to a similar contract with Coke, and we're flying over 1,000 miles of right-of-way every week, which is required. And so it's just to really what we were catching more than anything. It wasn't leaks. I mean, there's a lot of oil in Texas, and so these were moving crude oil, if you will. And so yes, we're looking for, you know, black spots on the ground, but really what we were capturing was encroachments. And so it could be something as simple as a rancher farmer has his tractor, you know, with a post hole digger, and he's just punching holes in the ground, moving across, you know, a half mile section of fencing. And believe it or not, some of these lines are 40, 60 years old, and some of them are actually on the surface. And so something that goes down 3 or 4 feet could cause a real problem to one of these lines. So we reported in the radio back in the day, encroachments was our primary things that we detected.
So I know we're going to talk about drones and aircraft, but I'll throw this in there real quick because you brought up a point, and that's when there are folks out there doing these surveys of corridors. And like you said, it may be just a visual survey. We actually, a previous company I worked for, we had a bore site in a park over here in Tampa, Florida. So our bore site was, and we'll get into these as well, our bore site was 24 leveled through survey control points in a park. So we could, you know, do the calibrations on our camera and so forth. But the one thing I got a kick out of was no matter when we were out there, you know, we'd hear it coming and all of a sudden the 172 would come blazing through the airspace at low altitude because he was following the power lines, right, doing his survey. So I'm familiar with what you're talking about. A necessary evil for everybody. Obviously they do, you know, they use different technology now, but it still has to be done. And that is still a type of acquisition, you know, that we're going to talk about mapping, but there's a lot of acquisition out there that may not involve mapping or may be modeling instead of mapping. So, drones have a space in both just as aircraft do. Before we get too deep here, let's go over some of the topics we're going to cover. And those would be, you know, differences between cameras, camera types, positioning systems, whether it be airborne GPS or PPK and RTK, the IMUs. Also, we're gonna talk about coverage area. So, you know, what can a drone cover versus what an aircraft can cover? And some of the challenges with that, the costs associated with, you know, acquisition itself. And then, you know, just to touch a bit on, you know, if there are differences in the processing workflow between drones and aircraft. So when you went from, you know, flying the 172s, At this point, you were already a business, correct? And
Oh, yes.
And then, what made you decide that, hey, maybe the next step is aerial photography, capturing data?
Really, it was a need for additional services, which would supply additional revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And so the contract said I won because I was the lowest bidder. And I realized after, and it was new to me, doing the pipeline surveillance, I realized that I was actually too low for my own good. And so prior to starting my company in 93, I had served as department head of information technology for FDIC out of Houston. And my claim to fame was RDBMS, Relational Database Management Systems. And I worked with Oracle, and Oracle was not a common word.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 years I'd worked in the high tech industry, a Fortune 500 company prior to that called Datapoint out of San Antonio. And so when it really got exciting was in 96, when all of my life experiences merged in the cockpit. So when I was able to bring a camera, which I had a love for photography, into the aircraft, and then was able to use that imagery in an engineering way, then it took off. And so I didn't even really know that much about photogrammetric processes at all. And that's why I described my first deliverable as an image map, because that's the only way I really knew how to describe it. We did geotag the image, so we had the orientation probably within 5 to 10 degrees of rotation, and the center was maybe within a couple hundred feet. But it's an image that could be pulled up, and visually the men that managed that right away could clearly see a fence line. Because keep in mind, when I was flying the pipeline patrol, I had an FAA waiver that allowed me to fly it at 100 feet AGL. I flew a treetop.
Jeez.
So I was in the drone world,
yeah,
before there were drones. And 120 feet, 150 feet, and just following the terrain.
Yep.
And so the image map that I delivered, I pulled the aircraft up to about 1,000 feet HEL, and then still fairly close. It was not a high resolution camera, but I was close enough to the target that the image quality was quite good. And you have to realize at that point in time, there were like mimeograph maps. There was a blue line maps. There was a map room. It was rolled up and they would extract that, go to that building, go to that room, pull out that map and roll it out on the hood of their truck to try to see what the lay of the land was. And so it was an instant success. They immediately doubled my rate. I'm just on the presentation in the conference room. And so I knew I was onto something good.
Yeah.
And so from there, I seriously started pursuing and educating myself on how I could deliver a better and better product. And here we are today with the technology that we've harnessed, that is, I'm still amazed with it, still fascinated with the accuracy of it.
Yeah, it's, interesting. Like you said, you were working in the world of drones before there were drones,
right.
Which, again, then there were no drones in the airspace. So, you could fly at those altitudes, which to me is basically barnstorming, which is really cool.
Right.
I totally understand that. And having a background in aerial mapping as well, we've been that low in my family business as well, way back in the day. But another point, you mentioned, you had previously worked, within the state and local government, on the database side. So you kind of had a good knowledge of, maybe what would be needed out there. And you mentioned, you were the low bidder and that, you found out that, maybe a little bit later, but there's also something to that, which is proximity. You can actually be the low bidder on many projects just because you're the closest person. So sometimes when people hear the connotation low bidder, they may have a negative connotation to that, but absolutely not. That comes down to the point of mobilization, the type of aircraft you're flying. There are all kinds of factors that make you fall within a bid range. So I you know, I always like to point that out to people. So, you know, having that capability. So now when you went to that step, what type of camera were you using?
The first camera I purchased was a, believe it or not, a 5 megapixel, mm-hmm. and I cannot remember the brand. It was in 95, and I used it only as a proof of concept, and I'm trying to remember the brand of it, and so it escapes me. But I immediately, once I was awarded the contract to ImageMap, I went out and bought a Hasselblad 203 FE, mm-hmm. and so I did go to film, and then of course I would scan the film,
yeah.
and you know, it's a 70 millimeter, it's a respectable format, you know.
Yeah,
it accomplished an awful lot of good with the Hasselblad 203, and then I used it for probably 3 to 4 years, and then I purchased an old 9x9 Fairchild T11, mm-hmm. and I refurbished it. I actually refurbished it. I took it to the machine shop, and we re-bored it out. I mean, we removed the lens. I bought the best lens I could, and then wound up buying my own shutter and got it focused. And so I was running with a, you know, 6-inch focal length 9x9 that had been upgraded, you know, from its old, gosh, it's probably from the early 70s, honestly, you know, and it's catered to black and white. And so now I had, you know, true color.
I see another commonality here. Because again, like I said, my family, we were involved in aerial photography as well. And I can remember, you know, coming home from high school and my dad was baking a new mount in the oven because there were no gyro-stabilized mounts then. And he, you know, he had the wherewithal to come up with one. And the painting technique he used involved baking the parts in the oven. So what that tells me is, and again, you know, an old Fairchild, that's, you know, that's pretty old. And, you know, back in those days, you know, we had to go through calibration and all the things, and we'll get to that. But the commonality I see is that a lot of folks in the drone world are doing similar things. You know, what can be bought off the shelf is great, and that's a start. But as we come up with new ideas or new opportunities, it takes, you know, a little bit of work on sensors, a little bit of, you know, intelligence on how systems work and things like that. And that's where I seem to think that people become really successful in what they do. So so you started with a Fairchild, and I can tell you, I went to work for a company in Kansas, and they had a, it was an old Jenna camera, and I think it was a surplus camera from the space shuttle missions that never went to space. Okay. So it still existed, and you know, they used that camera forever. So, you know, we could geek out about different types of cameras, the old RC10s, right, and so forth.
And we didn't calibrate. What we did do, we used a product called ER Mapper. Mm-hmm. We rubber sheeted the imagery to death.
Yep.
We'd throw a grid over it, and you know, that grid would wind up, say, if it's a 9x9, which it was, scan, we would probably have 25x25, you know, lines and rows. Mm-hmm. And we would find a point in every cell. And so the effect was semi-accurate. Of course, back then, a 1 meter deliverable was common.
Perfectly acceptable, yeah.
Yeah, perfect. It was, as far as image resolution. And so our accuracy, you know, it's nothing like we have today, you know,
right,
but it was effectual. It was effectual.
Right. So were you still flying 172s at that point?
I was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you had a hole in the hole in the belly and all of that, doing it the old school
way. I like to say it was ported, but yes.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, those advances that, you know, have come along, you know, originally, like you said, when you started with a handheld, you were able to geotag those because you captured the GPS information in that camera. As we move up to, say, you know, that Fairchild and on up from there, those didn't necessarily have that geotagging capability built into them. You were taking that information from GPS, you know, if you had airborne GPS or something like that installed in the aircraft, which I assume you got to that point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe originally that was a separate thing, but, you know, now I'm not sure, but I would think the ZI cameras, the big ones, probably have some geotagging capability built into them, as well as connecting to airborne GPS.
And we literally would just do a visual reference to AO, you know, and orient our images in that manner. You know, we didn't geotag until much later, until we started generating, you know, EO data real time.
Right.
And that was as late as 2013, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm. So some of the projects you were doing were probably bigger. You had a large format camera, so your footprint was much larger. You were probably flying at a higher altitude.
Absolutely.
So it's very easy to pick points on existing reference data and do your rubber sheeting back in those
days. Our largest project, we did an XTO oil field between Dallas and Houston, and we mapped 2,554 square miles. And delivered it as one ECW.
So let's talk about that real quick. So, you know, 2,000 square miles, how long did it take you to...
2,554.
Okay, and how long did it take you to acquire that, roughly?
Yeah, I actually captured it in a Cessna 172, and it was right at a one-foot resolution, and with a 9x9.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we captured it in 3 days.
In 3 days. Very good. So, and this was probably early 2000s?
This was mid-2000s.
Mid-2000s. Okay. So, mm-hmm. 1 foot resolution was obviously outstanding then. So, you know, we don't try to compare that to what's going on now and so forth. It's just kind of get an idea of the scale with which you can capture using aircraft versus using a drone. So
speaking of 1 foot, there's still a demand for 9-inch pixel resolution on countywide mapping, by the way.
Yeah.
9-inch, a lot can be done with a 9-inch, you know, take a tax assessment alone.
Yeah.
They're willing to identify structures that are, I believe, like 10 by 10 or larger,
mm-hmm.
you know, for purpose of tax.
You know, if a county's out doing something, you know, 3 inches is probably the max they're going to go, you know, and they would typically do reflights, you know, on an annual basis or something like that. But again, you're able to capture a much larger area with an aircraft to do that. And I don't think anybody's trying to do that with a drone or even a fleet of drones. But that's, you know, a bit of a difference there.
Here's one other just benchmark. Here's a benchmark. We were called, it was a bit of a mayday call from a local county, and they'd seen one of our presentations a couple months prior. And they called up and said they had a vendor not able to fly their county for tax assessment. And that's a smaller county. Mm-hmm. It was only about 250,000 square acres, 250,000 acres. And so that's a small county in Texas. That we were able to... respond. It was on Monday. We got the call. We flew it on Wednesday, the entire county in one day, and delivered it the next week using your software. And so I was quite impressed with it. And it was all 6-inch, by the way.
Yep. Well, you know, again, back to proximity. You know, there are a lot of aerial photography companies out there. Maybe less so than there were, you know, 3 years ago when a bunch of them got gobbled up, but contracts will be awarded to folks to fly from an area that they're not in, maybe because of cost or anything like that. But then when it comes time to perform, you know, whether weather is the reason or, you know, other obligations, they may not be able to fulfill that contract. They may come to you and either subcontract or, you know, just because of proximity, you're going to be able to work within those weather windows. Whereas they may not, because they have to mobilize from another state or farther away. That's a common thing in the aerial photography business. And honestly, that's why we have aerial photographers in, you know, pretty much every state and possibly even in all the major cities, is because, you know, they all know they can't be everywhere at once. So,
right. Yeah, my logistics has been what I call a round robin. I take off, I go to the target, and I return to home base. That has been our geographic limitation. I can count on one hand the times where I've gone and stayed in a hotel in the past, 25 years. And so where I'm located between Dallas and Shreveport, my radius is, I can run up to Tulsa easy, and I can go down to Houston quite easily. So that's the radius you just draw, San Antonio, reach over and touch Mississippi.
Yeah, and like I said, you could do that in a day, acquire the data, come back. So, therein lies a little bit of the challenge for those that are operating drones. And I had this conversation with a brother of mine who runs the family business. He can fly all over Los Angeles, capture 10 jobs, and be back in the same day, whereas, unfortunately for, a drone operator, they have to get in a car, get on the freeway, which is a nightmare in California, get to their location, capture their data on the batteries that they have, and then, if they're lucky, be able to return to their start place in one day. Now, that's not to say that's always the case. It isn't, but there's the limitations via mobilization. Now, on the flip side, if you need something done in the Caribbean, there might be a benefit to taking a drone out there if you can get it there, because we do have, flight restrictions. We do have, issues with getting to, say, another country, the Bahamas or things like that, where it's easier for a drone to slide in and out. Not to mention, those places are typically covered in clouds. So if you mobilize an aircraft out there, that aircraft might sit there for quite a while looking for those current conditions. So it does play both ways, in things like that. And also, I think of much more remote locations where, you've got a mining site in, Alberta somewhere, and you need something flown consistently. If that site is small enough, the drone is probably a good solution there, as long as it can handle the weather and all that, especially if there's no aerial photographer, local to that area.
Yeah, I really have. We've made the lion's share of our revenue off the coal industry, and now then it is greatly, greatly recessed. But a typical flight, someone like your brothers, we would capture from Louisiana down to the Austin area and capture as many as seven, eight different mining operations. And it was just extremely efficient, the aircraft was. And of course, we did migrate to the A36, the Bonanza A36, which has, longer legs and faster.
So, I mean, there's an economy of scale there, because you can, although an aircraft does cost a lot of money and maintaining it and the camera equipment and all of that, when you can knock out 7 to 10 jobs per day's flying, you are certainly competitive in that market compared to someone who's going to try to go out and capture that with a drone. That is certainly the case. So now you said you upgraded to a Bonanza. I believe you told me you have a Phase One camera now.
Yes. Yeah, we purchased the Phase One in 15, 16 time frame, 2015, and it's the i80 XA, and so it's 80 megapixel, and we've just had really been very pleased. That was the component I was trying to work with, an off-the-shelf Hasselblad, the H40. And I never could get the EO data. I couldn't get the midpoint exposure spot on. And with the Phase One, it dialed it in. And so we have excellent EO data now. We're really capturing at XYZ at the moment of the exposure. Super pleased with that. And then we did go ahead and purchase the calibration from Phase One. And then we, in years past, had purchased our own calibration software. And we ran it through both, or compared it, I should say. And we're quite pleased with our in-house calibration process. We have one aircraft hangar that the north wall is nothing but a grid pattern. The building is paid for itself, just being able to calibrate and get the results that is accurate. I mean, just very accurate internal mapping of the camera.
Yeah, so again, I'll do a little background on that. So calibrations used to be done by the USGS, And so for you to do any mapping job, you know, back in the day, in the, you know, before the 90s, your camera had to be calibrated by USGS, and you would literally send it in. You would schedule it, you would send it in, you would miss your camera for anywhere from 3 to 6 months while a bunch of scientists calibrated your camera to give you an AWAR rating, an average weighted area resolution rating. And if your rating wasn't over 100, you know, then you had issues with your lens or your camera geometry. So you were always looking for that rating of around 102 to 105, which is where all of the contracts required that you would be in. Towards the end of the 90s, of course, we had digital cameras come in. Digital cameras were never calibrated by the US because they just didn't have the ability to do that. And that, and the fact that when people were moving to digital cameras, they eventually closed the calibration labs that the USGS had. So now if you're flying an old camera, you're flying off a calibration, your last calibration, which again, these are metric cameras. They're designed to stay geometrically correct, intact. The lens is designed to stay the remain the same. It's fixed focal length. The camera body, it can handle temperature changes and things like that. So calibrations aren't necessarily needed that much. Whereas with drones, you know, unless we're talking about a phase one camera, most drone cameras are just off the shelf. You know, it's a Sony sensor. The body is plastic or maybe aluminum. There's really nothing to hold that thing geometrically together with temperature and changes and things like that. So that camera has to be calibrated all the time. Most mapping software will do or perform a calibration. Ours will, Correlator 3D will perform a calibration for you on the camera, and it'll correct for those errors. And you can actually export that calibration report. For those that have, you know, a high-end camera, you know, phase one or something like that, that came with a calibration report, they can do just the opposite. They can take their calibration report, import it into our software or other software, and tell the software, you know, don't mess with the camera parameters. They're good, and we'll get a good solution. Now, Marty, you're talking about a calibration field versus, say, a bore site, where you really have extremely tight control of coming up with a solution for the geometry of the camera. I don't know of very many people that even have their own, you know, calibration field. I know a couple of LiDAR companies that do, because for the most part, people would either accept what the manufacturer gives them as a calibration or an adjusted calibration from, say, a software like ours or, say, the one you purchased. But I will say that, you know, I have seen your data, and I mean, I was floored at how well it came in based on just your calibration. I was just, wow, that was really impressive. So much so that I shared it with the phase one guys and said, wow, this is, you know, this was done by Marty. It's not necessarily phase one calibration, which is still good, but this was, you know, outstanding. So
since you and I visited, we just got an order. It was confirmed yesterday. And we'll be mapping a small town in East Texas, and they're wanting to put in all new water lines, but they're requesting, you know, 1 foot contour over this 2 mile by 2.5 mile area. And, you know, I can confidently deliver those 1 foot contours, plus or minus 6 inches, you know, with this setup. We've done it many times before. We've been mapping some airports for the FAA, and they want 6-inch contours, plus or minus 6-inch. And isn't that amazing? You know, plus or minus 3-inch.
Right. So to explain this for people that may not, you know, be aware of the whole system and how the situation evolves, there are plenty of sensors out there or systems out there that have, say, airborne GPS and an IMU. Drones don't necessarily have a quality IMU in them, but there are a few that do. If it says Novatel, it's probably a pretty good IMU. If it, you know, there, I mean, there are other manufacturers of IMUs, but the more precise you can get the roll, pitch, and yaw of the unit in the aircraft, the more precise you can get its position from the airborne GPS. If you can correct for those, and you have a calibration that is well controlled, then you can actually use, say, a PPK solution without having to additionally rely on control. You're always going to want checkpoints, but say, for example, you ran a PPK solution with a high-grade IMU, a calibration that is spot on, you're going to hit the surface, you know, after processing the software, running the AT, the bundle adjustment, and all that, you're going to hit the surface spot on. And it's validated through checkpoints. Now, in the airborne world, originally PPK was invented for, you know, I'm out in the forest, I've got zero chance of getting any control on the ground, but I need to be close. And that's when people would use, say, an RTK or a PPK solution. There has been a movement in the drone world to accept PPK or RTK as gospel, which it's not, especially if you don't have those other three items in place, your airborne GPS, your IMU, and your camera calibration. It's not going to help you. So in the drone world, we often recommend, I do, is that you have control. If you want to run your solution with PPK, go ahead and run it. Then check it against the checkpoints. It's probably not going to be spot on. What you could do then is turn around and tell, for example, our software or anybody else's software, instead of running a PPK solution, run full AT unconstrained, which means the ground control is going to tell the software how to calibrate everything. And then you get, it's basically an upside down pyramid. You're correcting for things up there that have not been corrected for. So that is, you know, a difference between what's going on in the aircraft side and what's going on in the drone side. Obviously with airborne, much bigger footprint on all the images, which technically means you need less control. In the drone world, you're gonna, you know, it may take 40 images to capture, well, it may take 400 images to capture what two images in the airborne world capture. And it takes a lot less control there. So be aware of that when you're doing a, you know, considering a drone project versus an airborne project. You know, a drone, if you're doing a drone project, you should probably be a surveyor too and have your own survey equipment, or at least know what to ask for from the surveyors. When you're capturing, again, an airborne project, like you said, you know, 6-inch or available or good for 1-foot contours, that's high quality data with a lot less control. You know, economies of scale there, I think, dictate what's going on. Now, I mean, do you have any comments about the IMU and all of that stuff?
Yeah, our IMU, actually, that was a very good year. I purchased it in 2013. I needed a tax write-off, honestly. Uh-huh. And so I contacted Novatel, and they had an IMU. And then I said, then I let them know that I'm really not looking to save a dollar. And so they gave me a bump, and I didn't realize what a bump it was in terms of capability. It was the FSAS. Mm-hmm. Tactical grade IMU is extremely accurate. You know, it's military grade. Mm-hmm. And I'm so pleased that I was able to purchase it at that time.
One of the things where drones do excel at is in the world of modeling. So let's not be confused about the two. Mapping is taken from nadir photos or photos that are probably within 5 degrees of nadir, and you're capturing the surface and creating maps from that. Modeling is where you're flying, say, for example, a building, a cell tower, something like that, where you're capturing using a gimbal, and you're, you know, you may be encircling that, whatever that object is, capturing it, and then using the software to create a mesh of that item. It's more popular in the drone world just because you're looking for more finite details. In the airborne world, depending on what camera setup you have, you could do that. There are some multi-camera systems that have, you know, nadir and oblique cameras. There are some techniques you can do when you're flying. There's some offsets you can create to do that. That would be on a larger scale. So, you know, they might want, you know, a city block mapped for development purposes or anything like that. And you can capture that kind of stuff. I know you've shown me some of the stuff you've done with modeling, and it works. It's pretty nice stuff. I will say there's plenty of software out there that does modeling extremely well, and that's because their engines are more gaming engines. They deal with more triangulation and meshes, tighter tolerances than say, you know, a mapping software would do. But I mean, do you have any comments as to the future of that?
You know, I shared with you a capture that we did over our county seat. It's called Quitman, Texas. Mm-hmm. And I was quite impressed with the mesh. And that was actually done with a handheld camera, the Sony A7. But what we also did is we took that Bonanza, and I mean, it's the tightest capture we've ever done. We dropped the gear and put the flaps down, and we captured 1-inch pixel resolution over that same target area. And Wow. You haven't seen the results of this yet because I haven't completed it. But we did run it through your software, Correlator 3D, and we have a beautiful DSM. Mm-hmm. Now then, we'll take that output married up with, if you want to call it, the drone capture. And I think we're going to have something that city engineers are going to be most excited about. Not to mention your Chamber of Commerce, who's trying to promote the city from a visual standpoint and also from a business standpoint. Because where the world is headed with all the 3D rendering and the Oculuses of the world, you can take a virtual tour of Quitman, Texas from anywhere and really have a powerful marketing vehicle to invite people to East Texas, this East Texas town. So I'm exploring that. It's going to be interesting to see where it takes me. And I see that as, if you want to call it a merge between drone and traditional mapping capabilities, you know, with a fixed wing aircraft. And so I'm liking just the intrigue of it all. And it may require 2 flights, may not, you know, when I figure out how to configure the aircraft properly. You know.
Well, you're right. And the other thing I was thinking, and we talked about this before, there's, you know, again, the opportunity to merge data sets. Whether we're talking about, you know, something that was captured with drones to get, you know, just enhanced information, something that was captured with, say, for example, mobile LiDAR or terrestrial LiDAR. And then you have that blanket coverage from the aircraft. And what we're getting is a comprehensive data set that, you know, there's a company out there called Aerometrics. A good friend of mine, Casey Adams, lives down the street, also a big Tampa Lightning fan. He works at Aerometrics, and that's T-R-E-X is how it ends. And they're modeling entire cities. And they're modeling it to extremely good detail. They capture with helicopter, they capture with aircraft, they have, you know, handhelds on the ground, and then they build these comprehensive data sets. I think their business is more about hosting and creating these models, but it still takes local aerial photographers to capture that information. And it still takes the mind of, you know, a city council to say, hey, maybe we contracted this as a mapping project, but, you know, for this add-on, we can get, you know, oblique imagery. We can get these kind of deliverables about them. We can work in unison with both aerial photographers and with drone acquisition and with LiDAR companies to capture a more comprehensive data set. I mean, what do you think about that kind of stuff?
It'd be exciting. And you touched on something where that perhaps after I go around this ballpark, I realize that maybe I ought to just really do what's my mainstay, but realizing I could work in conjunction with drone companies. Let me do what I do. Let me create you that beautiful DSM that's quite accurate. And then you go out and capture the mesh with your drones. And together, you know, we deliver to the client.
Yeah. And, you know, from our end at SimActive, you know, we can ingest all of those data sets. So we can ingest the drone imagery, we can ingest the satellite imagery, the aircraft imagery, we can even ingest, you know, LiDAR data if it's given to us. So at this point, let's talk a little bit just about the workflow differences between, say, drone operation and an aircraft operation. And really, there isn't much difference at all. You would typically do your tie point extraction after importing the imagery. From there, if you've got GCPs, you're going to measure your GCPs. You would do your bundle adjustment to get your AT solution. If your AT solution is good, you can either move on and create your own DSMs and DTMs, your surfaces in Correlator 3D. If you happen to have a LiDAR data set of the same area, you can import that LiDAR data set. We are raster-based software, so we will convert it into a DSM or a DTM. From there, you can do any editing you want, and then you would do your ortho-rectification. Since we're not talking about rubber sheeting anymore these days, you would do your ortho-rectification, then you would create your mosaics, and then you could do your editing on your mosaic, export that out for use in other software. And then we talked a little bit, you know, to kind of close this off. One of the challenges for drones is that, you know, obviously there's an altitude ceiling that currently the FAA holds them to. You know, they can get waivers to go beyond that and do things like that, you know, with a lot of work with the FAA. Working within visual line of sight is the other challenge. You can get beyond that. You can get BVLOS if you can prove that you can manage that. And there are very few BVLOS waivers out there, but there are some. Then you've got to deal with just the amount of time that the drones can fly, basically because of size. If it's a quadcopter, it's going to do very small projects. It's going to do things like accident reconstruction, maybe a local stockpile, something like that. You know, again, whereas you can do 10, 15 of those in a day, they might get one or two or three. The other things that, you know, that they can do, obviously, as you start to move towards fixed wing, then your range gets a little bit bigger. In fact, your range gets big enough that line of sight becomes the issue. So, you know, if you stood in the middle of a cornfield, you could probably see your drone out to a quarter mile, half mile, in every direction. Right. So you could capture a mile, which is probably as long as the battery would last anyway. Right. So, you know, if you run across a project that's 20 square miles, if you could get four flights in with a drone per day, you're going to, you know, or six, you're going to need five drones to capture that 20 square miles. So is it in your best interest as a drone operator to spend your time doing that? My recommendation would be find out who the local aerial photographers are, become friends with them, create that relationship, because if you're using Correlator 3D, you can process that software. They'll go out and acquire it for you. And, right. You know, with their knowledge and their experience, I got to say, you know, aerial photographers have been around a lot longer than drone acquisition folks. So they're pretty good about estimating projects, getting projects flown, delivering data to you, whether you want it raw or whether you want it processed. There's a cohesiveness there that, you know, we shouldn't look at one system necessarily being better than the other. Obviously, there are advantages. The larger the project, the farther away it is, things like that, you're going to benefit from using an aircraft. But there are situations, like we talked about, where drones have value too and will bring that value to the table. So I think in a best situation, the use of both, the ability to rely on the skills and talents on each side, whether it's experience on the aerial photography side, whether it's the ability to capture super high resolution on the drone side, we can all learn something from each other.
That's why being able to meet with you, Eric, has been most exciting. I really appreciate your company. I appreciate how it's helped us be most successful, by the way. And then in our time of need of support, which I think has been somewhat minimal based on our background, but when we have needed tech support, and that's how I met you, Eric. Yep. And I really appreciate your help to me personally, you know, in our hours of need.
Well, I hope that, you know, the software itself is self-explanatory, that our information that we provide, our support, our help information, all of our webinars and our tutorials are there for people when they need them. You know, it's kind of how I ended up at SimActive. You know, my background is photogrammetry and aerial photography, but I've used this software in almost every company I've gone to. I find it works very well, and I hope that what we're doing here is providing everybody with the knowledge and information they need to be successful with the software as well. So, you know, with that, I would like to thank Marty for his time.
Be good, Eric. Thanks for having me on. And I hope that this conversation is perhaps helpful. And I welcome follow-up as well.
My thanks to everybody who has joined us for this podcast. If you like what you've heard, please share on social media.